Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Christy Dames with the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled Cloud Computing and Customers, Strategies for Success. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org and to learn about any of the many fine programs being held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers for tonight. Chris Jones, on the far side, Principal Engineering of Engineering and Strategy for Hot Studio, which is a San Francisco and New York-based firm. For the past 16 years, Chris has partnered with clients like Zinio, SF MoMA, Linden Lab, and Cisco to create innovative digital experiences that delight customers and grow business. Grounded in people-centered design philosophies, he works with clients to develop digital strategies and leverage emerging technological opportunities. He has held executive positions at Radar Networks, Liquid Agency, Sapient, Studio Archetype, and Landor. Our other speaker tonight is Ian McFarland, CTO of Digital Garage. Ian was working on worldwide distributed hypertext systems with Ted Nelson a couple of years before Tim Berners-Lee proposed the World Wide Web, HTTP, and HTML. He was on the launch team at Hotwired and was employee number 4 at Friendster, which was the company that kicked off this whole social media thing. For the past 7 years at Pivotal Labs, he's been sharing insights into agile development with companies large and small, and helped to grow Pivotal from a small company to a world-renowned team of over 100 developers. Since joining Digital Garage as its CTO in August, he's taken these ideas back to Japan, the country where both Lean and Ruby come from. I think you're going to really enjoy tonight. These two folks are right in the center of this entire phenomena called cloud computing, and they're actually making it easy and understandable, and I think you're going to really enjoy this program. Thanks. I'm going to turn our program now over to Chris Jones.
Well, thanks for the introduction. My name is Chris Jones, and Ian and I this evening wanted to have a conversation around cloud computing and trying to put it in terms of business and customers, not just in terms of technology. There's some great definitions out on the web that you can search for, and it's very much around accessible technology, ways for people to manage infrastructure. And I think that's true. There is a technology story there, but there's also very much of what's happening in technology and how that's affecting customers and businesses right now. And so we just wanted to have a conversation around that this evening. And it's really an outgrowth of, you know, we hear in email all this jargon that's going on. You know, it's so sort of overloaded with, you know, it's gonna be the new teeth whitener. It's gonna help you lose 10 pounds, you know, overnight. It's gonna make all your technology dreams come true. And the truth of the matter is there is something there, but it's not sort of a panacea that's gonna solve everything. And I think that's what we wanna talk about. We want to try to put this into a historical context to help us understand where did this come from, what does this mean right now, and possibly where is it going?
And really, why is it transformational? I mean, I think cloud, it's very easy for people to talk about cloud as this, you know, to your point, about as this big thing. It is fundamentally changing business models. It is fundamentally changing certainly the startup ecosystem, but also the large IT ecosystem. But it's really, that's the part that's interesting. It's not, to your point, it's not about the technology at all. It's about sort of what the impact is on business and the social impact. Right. And I think we want to try to get into that a little bit today.
So I think just a brief history of where we've been and where we may be going. You know, when we think about technology in the sort of internet time frame, at least, we look back maybe, you know, 10, 15 years ago, maybe 20 at this point, sort of the pre-commercial internet. Networks and the internet have actually been with us for a long time. But really there was the idea of there were individual systems, my individual computer, and I might sort of participate in a bulletin board system or send an email, but it wasn't really sort of the idea of a networked system. It wasn't really core to computing.
And it wasn't sort of one network back then either. You know, to your point, you're going to bulletin board systems or a bunch of discrete systems to try to find information. And the World Wide Web sort of coalesced that into this one. It was called the Internet because it's actually a network of networks.
Right. Yeah. And so as time moved on, you know, although there was sort of a technology stage of sort of the pre-commercial Internet, people didn't think of things as a connected world. And then we moved into the commercial Internet. Commerce was now sort of enabled on the Internet. And that became a way for new businesses and people to start thinking about technology in a different way.
And it's easy to forget that wasn't really a foregone conclusion at all back in 1994 when I was working at Hotwired. The notion of a commercial Internet was actually controversial. It was actually something that people weren't sure it was going to be okay. We weren't even sure ourselves whether NSFNet, one of the federally funded networks, would even carry our advertising traffic. And I think it's almost just an accident of history that I think it's probably Wired's ethos and how we had this brand that was around cyber rights, mostly because of the content that we were publishing, where people believed in us and let us commercialize the Internet in this way. Banner ads are still with us, right? I mean, these are still how an awful lot of companies make money on the Internet, and it's just an artifact of sort of where we were back in 1994.
Yeah. And so as we moved from the sort of pre-commercial Internet into a commercial Internet phase, in the recent sort of, half decade or so, we've been talking about Web 2.0, and that's sort of been the meme that's been traveling around. And this is really sort of a recognition of the user's participation in the network. That is YouTube with user-generated content and blogs and social networks, people connecting and sharing information.
People becoming producers of information as much as consumers of information.
Absolutely. So the last few years have actually really seen, this sort of inflection point where now businesses and people and their customers are sort of getting on a level playing field. They're making decisions about their products together, about taking things forward. And so I think then that leads us to kind of where we are today. And that is what maybe sort of a post-Web 2.0 world. Some people will call this Web 3.0. I'm going to sort of stay away from that trend line. But we are sort of seeing a change now where we're talking about cloud computing. And we're going to spend a good deal of time talking about that this evening. But that is really sort of all of these resources being pooled together in sort of this cloud of resources. There's a couple of other interesting trends that I think we want to touch on as well on this is smart data. There's a lot of, with all this data that's been created, AI processes are coming to fruition. We're starting to see systems that are starting to help make decisions. Recently, there was a product called Siri, came out of SRI, and it was quickly acquired by Apple within 6 months of launch for $200 million. So it's, we're seeing these things that are where artificial intelligence and the ability to sort of infer meaning out of data is becoming really important, and also ubiquity. So computing experiences are happening on desktop, mobile, tablet, TV. It's almost sort of the differentiation between those experiences is really sort of going away, and there's an expectation of that computing experiences are happening across the board. Mm-hmm. So just wanted to kind of set up where we've come from a little bit. Let's think back into sort of historically, how do we get to cloud computing, and what's the model that people had in their minds, particularly interacting with systems. So in the pre-commercial Internet, someone would get into their car, they would go to a mall in a parking lot, and they would go to a Borders bookstore, and they would fill up their basket, and they would buy books. And in doing that, they're sort of implicitly working with a couple of different systems. They're working with the Borders inventory system. They may be looking up authors. And they're also working with a point-of-sale system. And they're transacting, and they're getting their credit card processed. And those systems are sort of, they are coupled together, but it's not explicit. The user is not really aware of that. They're just like, hey, I looked up an author, I bought a book.
Often those are mediated by the people in the store. The customer's not actually even touching the computer systems.
Exactly, yeah. And so as when the commercial internet came along, all of a sudden people became aware of these services starting to get integrated together. There was an inventory system with all your books. You know, there was a cart, and that cart allowed you to carry those things around. You could decide how to gift those items in that cart. There was management of your credit cards, your address book, integrated shipping and tracking. So all of a sudden, the user now, as you get into the commercial internet, has a different model of the relationship between, in this case, shopping and the technology behind it.
And a lot of these started out as discrete systems. Like, for example, oh, your FedEx tracking. Well, you go to the FedEx site and see where your package is. That started to become integrated into the user experience, where you just go to Amazon now and click through, and you're still getting the information from FedEx or from UPS or from whatever fulfillment. But there's a seamless user experience that's built on top of these different web-based services.
And so little did we know, sort of like as that system was being built, that was sort of the kernel of where cloud computing would eventually come from. And that is, you have a user logs onto their computer, they connected through the internet with some ISP, AOL, et cetera, and they're connected with the idea of a server. So this is a new thing that's actually was introduced, the idea of that there's an electronic system called the server that's providing you services. And that server is actually integrating with a point-of-sale system, with the shipping and tracking, with inventory management, and it's doing that all for you and providing you a website.
And all these discrete services are sort of coalescing into this one seamless experience, again, sort of just based on these web standards that were introduced.
Mm-hmm. And so to take a look deeper at that, to support that, each one of these systems, so the point of sale system, the credit card transactions, the shippers, the inventory management systems, would have to build their own network. So their network, all their servers, all their database servers, and they started to create some sophisticated layers of technology behind that. So and as Amazon, let's use them as an example, grew, as they went global, as they started to sell more than just books, they started to sell toys and clothing, they started to actually have to solve a lot of really interesting technology problems, particularly ones of scale. So, hundreds, thousands of servers, many databases that had to interoperate, address books, credit cards, passwords, interact with different kinds of inventory management systems, and distribute that globally.
And do it in a way that has very low latency, so the end user isn't exposed to the complexity of the system.
Right, exactly. And they did that, and they actually were, in a way, a great case study is Toys R Us. Toys R Us had their own website. They were selling toys off of that. They were actually the largest install base of a product called Cold Fusion at the time. And they realized that this was not their core business, that being a website and e-commerce was not Toys R Us's core business. And so they made a deal with Amazon for Amazon to actually provide that e-commerce. And so all of a sudden, now Amazon's actually being a service to other traditional businesses, which is also having to increase its scale and to solve those problems. The problem is that, traffic's not uniform. On Monday, you'll have a lot of traffic. On Tuesday, you may not have much. In November, you'll have a lot of traffic if you're selling toys. Other industries and other websites have different patterns. So what you had to do is actually you have to build your operation and your infrastructure well ahead of what your maximum is going to be. And it becomes a huge investment that you need to make in infrastructure.
It becomes a huge capital investment that you have to plan and get right.
Right.
And you have to do a lot of sort of back-of-the-envelope modeling and sometimes much more detailed modeling to try to get to where you feel like you have enough capacity for whatever you think your peak is going to be, and actually quite a bit above what you think your peak is going to be, because the last thing you want is, Black Friday comes once a year. If everything's down for that day, guess what? You just lost, 10% of your revenue for the year.
Yeah. So you end up with all these valleys and opportunities where your servers aren't actually active.
Right.
And so what you do about that is you start to think about, rather than my systems, my network or my server or my database as sort of physical infrastructure, I start to think about them as sort of abstracted virtual machines. virtual, you know, apparatus that I can actually scale depending on what's needed for that day. So you can imagine particularly for a shopping cart, you know, in the middle of summer, my shopping cart machine doesn't have to be that robust. On Black Friday, it has to be very robust. Same with databases. You know, I may need to, you know, how do I scale with continually growing data sets? Mm. And so ultimately, you'll hear the term virtualization a lot in the sort of cloud computing world. And this is the idea that I can actually take systems and sort of virtualize them and put them across multiple machines. So I get away from counting machines and I start thinking about little virtual machines. And that's sort of one of the cornerstones of this. And I can start to pool all these little virtual devices into a cloud.
And you can make more of them on demand using the resources of the cloud.
Right. So once I've done that, I'll come back to, you know, the idea that I'll still have sort of peaks and valleys in activity, but now those valleys can become opportunities for me because I can start to fill those valleys with other virtual machines that may not necessarily be my business. In effect, it's like a remnant sale, or it's sort of subleasing office space. I buy a lease on an office space that's larger than what my initial capacity might be, and I can sublease that, you know, maybe at a discount, maybe at a profit, you know, some upside involved in that. But I can, because I have now virtualized things, I can start to assign those machines not just to my company. So in Amazon's case, you know, Amazon has a cloud. They can run their services within that cloud, but they can start to sublease those machines to other services. And those services may not need the same kinds of capacity at the same time. So you can sort of start to, what they would say, load balance across that cloud. And they can price that, you know, based on the demand. So, for instance, if you can get sort of lower performance machines at a lower price. And it allows you to sort of start to optimize your hardware and all your infrastructure investment so that over time, rather than saying, you know, okay, I'm going to fill those valleys up, those remnants up, with other services and start to market towards other companies and have a pricing structure that's effective for them and helps fill in those gaps. And then it allows me to have a predictable capital investment.
Well, it lets you make those investments based on actual demand instead of based on projected demand.
Right. Yeah.
And that's really revolutionary. From the economics of that are fundamentally different from what, you know, we're used to before. You know, back in Friendster days, one of the big things we had to do was go raise $17 million in investment so that we could buy hardware. And that's not how people operate startups anymore. That's just not how people do it anymore. And it's very liberating to not have to, I mean, first of all, not to have to do the capacity planning based on that, but beyond that, to just be able to start incrementally with a small footprint and then grow your OPEX as you actually have traffic to justify it.
And it changes the way sort of startups can start, as Ian was saying, as you start to sort of the economics of that. Let's say rather than having to go out and spend $100,000 on server infrastructure and write a lot of code to get it out there, before you even find out if your customers are going to buy it, you know, use the service, now your cost of entry is almost zero. So it's really actually your own time to test out, you know, whether a customer is going to buy something or not. And, you know, I can get something into market at a very low cost.
Mm-hmm.
I can either optimize or I can just sort of cut bait, you know, and sort of this whole sort of fail fast mentality starts to accelerate innovation and development. So we talked a little bit about sort of the history of what was going on in e-commerce and how the cloud and the infrastructure comes along. A couple of other things are going on at the same time in the technology space that I think are also sort of, you know, there's a sort of a confluence of opportunity being created at this time. First off is social networks are starting to explode. You know, you have traditional online businesses like Yahoo has been around for 15 years. It's got a steady state of business. It's sort of had some challenges in the last few years. And you have new entrants like Facebook, you know, within the last 6 years or now that traffic is surpassing a company like that. And they're you know, so we have this sort of this social networked community and space that's really taking a foothold in our culture.
And just, I mean, the numbers are just kind of hard to comprehend even. The fact that 750 million users of Facebook exist, you know, 250 million users of Twitter. I mean, these are really, not everybody has a computer, by the way, right? A lot of people don't happen to live in the United States and have all the, you know, all the technology, that the toys that we have. But, I mean, these are just astounding numbers, and this is where people are finding, like, expressing their identity.
Also, at the same time, internet businesses that are maybe not traditional businesses are exploding. So we've talked a little bit about the social networks, Facebook. You know, 51% year-over-year growth. I mean, that's tremendous growth. Mm. The same with what's happening in the mobile space and what the user experiences on those devices are happening. You know, iOS, over 100% year-over-year growth. Google still continues to expand at a healthy clip. And the economics of it are not just sort of selling hard goods like books and clothing, but you're hearing like downloads of apps and virtual goods and ads, and people are selling different kinds of things on the internet. So the business models are also changing, and how we value businesses are changing.
And this mobile piece, of course, is going to be a growing consideration, right? More and more people are using mobile devices as their only means of connecting to internet services. More and more people won't be having desktop computers anymore at all, and will be only, you know, just using smartphones. What we consider a feature phone today will probably go away in the next 5 years, and you know, the cheap phone that folks, not just in the developed world but in the developing world, will be using will also have these capabilities and be very capable platforms for people to interact with information.
And so as people are adopting these devices into their homes and into their use, you're starting with these really complex networks just within the home. Digital cameras, laptops, cell phones, tablets, you know, how these things interact, their TVs, and, you know, as even, you know, as we start to think about smart meters and the electrical grid, you're going to start to see even more things starting to get networked together. So just even within like an individual's personal space, you're seeing many sort of connected devices. And it so happens that one of the benefits of the cloud is that it actually speaks just as well to, you know, a cloud application talks just as well to a web browser as it does to a mobile device. And data starts to explode. So something like YouTube, where they're actually storing, almost, you know, taking in almost a petabyte a year. And we're comfortable with that size. I mean, that's 1,000 terabytes, which is 1,000 gigabytes. And in addition to the data that we're sharing online, so this is a, you know, there's one stat where right now 35 hours of video is being uploaded to YouTube every minute. You know, the amount of content's well outstripping people's ability to consume it. What's also happening is the amount of data that's being logged about the activity is enormous. So there's the background tasks. So for instance, I have a client who logs over 1 trillion log entries per day on the activity over their network. So they are seeing an enormous amount of information about people's use and being able to mine that information and use that for billing purposes and understanding network optimization. But so you have, on one side you have the amount of data being stored and created for consumption and sharing, but also the amount of data just being used to track all that is enormous in and of itself.
And this is one of the things that's like basically without cloud infrastructure, it would be very hard to do very much with that information. One of the things that we're also starting to realize is how valuable that information actually is. It tells us a lot about user behavior. It tells us a lot about buying behavior, things that are monetizable, things that are socially important. We need scalable infrastructure to be able to do something with all the data. We're kind of comfortable now that we should just be keeping that data. Back, you know, in the 90s, when we looked at data like that, we figured out, like, how do we get the information we need out of it as quickly as possible and then get rid of it? more and more of that information is just being stored because we don't know what questions we want to ask of it until later in the life of the data.
Sharing becomes sort of a social currency as well. So the amount of information that I share and how I share it becomes a way that I'm valued and I value myself in these networks. This is another thing that is really changing us culturally and happening at the same time. So my blog, my MySpace page, when MySpace was sort of the place to be, Twitter, now I can go into a restaurant and I can sort of say, hey, I'm at this restaurant, this is what I know about this restaurant, and I can leave my sort of virtual notes about that, and my friends can come in later and see, oh, this is what, Chris thought about this restaurant, or, oh, hey, he was here yesterday, for instance. So now my sort of personal persona is being imprinted on the virtual world, and that's becoming a very important piece of my brand or my social currency.
And it's also being indirectly imprinted on the real world.
Yeah.
And the fact of, we don't really talk about it, but the collection of location-based information starts to attach these things like don't eat the fish at this restaurant to this place, so that when you go to this place, that information is available to you now. We have this whole new indexing mechanisms that are intrinsic in the physical space that we're in that we're starting to attach to all this data.
Mm-hmm. So another really interesting thing going on at the same time is the need for transparency in our companies. So the recent financial crisis really actually punctuated people's need for transparency in their brands that they work with. And we're seeing, customers at all levels in the economy and economics saying, I'd much rather have an accessible partner or service provider that maybe, and I'd be willing to give up a little bit of performance in that. So rather than saying, I want the best performing financial advisor that's inaccessible, I'm prefer to find actually a financial advisor that's more accessible and maybe isn't the top performer. And that's sort of a big transition. And so for people to give up a little bit of premium in terms of like performance of that service in return for accessibility and transparency is really important. And services like Twitter are supporting that and helping that.
And in fact, they're creating transparency even when companies don't intend for it to occur. The fact is you can go comment on Twitter or on Facebook on brands that you interact with. And when something bad happens, it has reach. There's a great video, the United Broke My Guitar video. If you go look that up, it's quite amusing YouTube video. This is somebody who wasn't getting satisfaction from customer service, and they made a really wonderful little video about what it feels like to be a United customer. These platforms are actually creating a place where even where companies don't want the transparency, it's kind of foisted upon them. And they're having to respond to that, and it's changing the way companies have to interact with customers.
Really briefly on smart services. There are machines making automated trades out there. There are making automated recommendations. And, if Anne Hathaway is in the news, does that mean that Warren Buffett becomes wealthier?
Well, actually, yes. Turns out, this was studied recently. There was an interesting case where people were noticing this trend in the data that said every time Anne Hathaway did something in the news, Berkshire Hathaway stock went up, and it was finally attributed to automated trades that were not appropriately selective in terms of what they were looking at. So there are a lot of unintended consequences, and this new frame, this access to data, means that we have to sort of challenge some of our assumptions about what news means or what indirect data we're actually being exposed to.
On sort of more on the technology side as well, open source and open standards are becoming really sort of the big kid on the block. Like the idea that you don't need commercial software to build huge applications any longer is really becoming a permanent fixture in the technology landscape. Yeah. And also the idea of open standards. So the idea that I'm going to define how systems will interoperate and talk to each other and sort of plan for the future, and not be proprietary about how things talk is also really facilitating some of this, the underpinnings of what's going on right now.
And the fact is, even where commercial software is used, it's being used based on open standards. I mean, the fact is, nobody's using the web not using HTTP or HTML. You can't. The open standard won. So whether you're using a commercial product or a non-commercial product, that almost stops being the question anymore. I mean, I think as you start to get into different APIs, the HTTP has really created the space where you can create and orchestrate seamlessly services that are running in different locations. And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, what we think of as cloud is really just sort of the logical expression of what a connected web-based technology space gives you.
So with all of these sort of the confluence of all these things coming together, you start to see some new businesses emerge and really sort of challenge the entrenched players. One sort of notable one is Netflix, and they've been in the news a lot recently. They actually ended up having to build their own cloud. They've now moved streaming data and movies over to every device. It's become a core piece of their business, so core, in fact, that they're actually spinning off, in a way, their traditional business of delivering DVDs now. So you can see that, and they challenged the entrenched, $3 a night rental. They came up with a new business model based on how could, what do customers really want, and how do we support that? It's a monthly fee. I get, there's rules of the game around that, but it's simpler. And it's easier for people to use, and it's actually a better licensing deal for the studios than the original one was. They can actually, the customer lifetime value for a subscription play like Netflix is actually better than sort of the one-off $3 night rental. So Netflix had to build their own cloud. They had to sort of build all this infrastructure to make that happen.
And mostly because it wasn't otherwise available commercially when they started. It's not because they thought that was a better approach, but just because you couldn't just go to Amazon and put stuff on, S3 and to get started.
Then comes along a company like Dropbox, which you may or may not have heard of. They're an online storage solution. They synchronize between different devices. Here's a company who's raised less than $10 million in the last, since they were founded in 2007. They now do $100 million a year in revenue, and they're valued somewhere between $1 and $4 billion. It's a tremendous growth, a tremendous opportunity, and they have built this on top of Amazon's web services. Their initial investment in actually creating that service was very small. They certainly have a lot of operational costs around that, but again, a very accessible technology. They could build very quickly with a small investment up front and become a huge valuation.
And a small local team. I mean, they're just over in Potrero Hill. They're a little tiny company, built something that they really believed in, and they were able to launch it and scale it because they could rely on Amazon Web Services as a scalable back end for storing arbitrarily large amounts of data. Not something that, by the way, most people can sort of figure out how to do off the start. I mean, by now, obviously, they would have solved that problem, but they probably would have never had the opportunity to solve that problem otherwise.
Another example is Giglogs, which is Ian's company.
So the first two you may have heard, the first one you almost definitely heard of, the second one probably a lot of you have heard of, the third one probably nobody here has heard of, and this was a small experiment that I did. It was basically I wanted to try out a social application that was around collecting information about when somebody went to see live music, basically just a place for them to share that information. I wanted to test the hypothesis that just through Twitter and Facebook you could generate awareness of a product and then it would become sticky and would grow. So I did an experiment, and what I did was, over the course of 2 weeks, using a company called HyperTiny, which is a small Irish company, one developer, one designer, they built a first product, got it into the market 2 weeks from when we started. Total cost of, at that time, it would be more now, but total cost of $15,000. We built a web application that's in production today. We found out something really interesting. We found out that people going to music events doesn't happen frequently enough to really form habits. And we've decided that, you know, we could have pivoted the company, we could have done something different, but we also decided that, well, we just did a $15,000 experiment, and we decided that that's not the place where we want to focus right now. So the ones that don't succeed are almost more interesting than the ones that do, because, I mean, when we look at what internet companies are successful, we always see, you know, the Googles of the world, the Amazons of the world, these ones, and why do we see them? Because they were successful. So one of the things that's essential, I think, that cloud really enables is the ability to take risks, to experiment, and to take these small ideas and make them potentially into, you know, billion-dollar companies like Dropbox, or potentially not, but not spend, you know, if I'd done this 5 years ago, it would have cost me 2 years of my life. We would have had to go raise, you know, go convince some VC to spend $1 to $2 million trying this out. And at the end of it, we would have had the same result, except for I'd be 2 years older, and I'd have to explain to my VC what I did with their money.
So I'm just going to talk quickly about, so I think hopefully we're getting sort of a sense that the cloud is, you know, it is a powerful set of technologies. It's enabling some new businesses, and it's enabling innovation at a very low cost to the people who want to participate. Mm. But we also want to think about what does this mean to consumers and what's going on in their head. Traditionally, people think about their computers, I've got my applications and I've got my stuff. And now that I've got my computer, that's got my applications and my stuff, and some of that stuff is in a network service like Twitter or Dropbox or Gmail. And I can start to experience those things through multiple devices. So my phone, my tablet, my laptop, and I can start to think about, you know, more services happening in the cloud. And of course, my friends are doing that at the same time. So my model of my interaction with technology is really expanding because of what's going on in the cloud. All these different services tied together through different devices, and they're tying all my friends together. And so this then actually starts to raise some really interesting questions for people. You know, how do I share information? You know, what do people know about me? How do I control that? Facebook is certainly, you know, commonly challenged about, you know, the rules of privacy and how people have control over that. And it's just going to continue to be a complex task for people to manage that. And they have to do it themselves. There's no one looking out for you.
And it's starting to change how people think about privacy. And I think there's an expectation of privacy that a lot of us in the room grew up with that the, you know, teenagers and young adults today don't actually have. So, I mean, on some level, we have to look at that, too, and sort of decide what's right there, what's reasonable, and transparency is... It's actually changing also how we look at certain things. Like, some things that we maybe would have been embarrassed about sharing are things that kids today are fine sharing, and maybe they're actually more tolerant and accepting. But it's a very complex space that's sort of being created by the amount of information that's available about people. Yeah.
And so, you know, and you're putting your stuff out there, and who knows about your stuff? And who owns that content? When I put a photo on Facebook, Facebook owns that photo. That's their property now. And not everyone's aware of that. And so how do people start to manage that information? And same, you know, I think that's really an important piece for people to think about. And at the end of the day, there's a really important piece here is that crisis and fraud touches a lot of everyone, not just the individuals it touches now. So we see the sort of downside of this is that, you know, when I want to conduct some, you know, when if I want to do some fraud, I can not just do it at 10,000 letters that go out or emails that go out. I can do this at millions of people at a time, you know, and I can set up shop very quickly and disappear very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Anywhere.
Anywhere. Anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. So, and right now, you know, people have to manage this all on their own. And sort of take into account, like, where is my identity? Is, you know, Facebook is becoming sort of an arbiter of it. You know, when I log into Facebook or I log in to make comments on a blog, I'm logging into Facebook commonly. Mm-hmm. So they're managing my identity. And this is all of these cloud services have, you know, their particular terms of use and conditions around ownership of content and my identity. So just as we close, I think it's, you know, wanted to sort of think about this a little bit in historical context. You know, early on, in a way, we can think about that early shopping experience is sort of nomadic trading. I go out to the mall, I buy some stuff online. You know, I'm sort of, you know, there's really, it's not really a connected experience. Over time, we sort of start to have established trade routes that eBay and Amazon and advertisers start to actually really establish patterns. And there's outposts along those trade routes that people start to take ownership of. So you can start to see some growing patterns. I think now, if we were to make a metaphor with history, we're sort of in the age of sort of empires, starting to take ownership of those trade along those trade routes, and really starting to want to say, like, these are my populations, this is where commerce is happening, I want to control that commerce, take advantage, you know, make opportunity come from that. And so we're seeing that in the social space, we're seeing that in the enterprise spaces, we're seeing that in the commerce spaces, where, you know, the Amazon, Salesforces, Facebooks are really trying to carve out sort of niches that own a certain amount of population. And when we look at sort of all the players and think primarily sort of in the consumer space, the enterprise space, and business space is another piece of it, but the Googles and Apples and Amazons and Microsofts and Facebooks, there's no real heir apparent to taking that on. They all have their strengths. They all have their weaknesses. They all have lots of capital and resources to do whatever they need to, but, you know, for instance, Apple owns some great use cases out there. It has a lot of capital to do stuff with, but they've never really figured out collaboration. They've never really understood, like, a group of people working together and bound together. It's always like the iPad, an individual experience.
And then Google, on the other side, understands cloud really well, but doesn't really understand usability all that well, other than simplicity.
Yeah. And Amazon's actually really a technology leader in this space. Mm-hmm. You know, ahead of, you know, of Microsoft, and so who knows where this is really going? But you can start to see that, like, maybe that modern nation actually rises out of these empires, where users start to actually really take ownership of their identity and what they want out of computing experiences, and start to take ownership of what that cloud might be, and maybe it's their own cloud for themselves on their terms. I think right now, though, we're comfortably sort of in the empire world. We're happy citizens handing over our photos and our identity to other services, and we're okay with that.
As long as the bread and circuses keep happening, everyone's pretty okay.
You know, I think that's the general gist of things. How long that will last, I don't know, you know, but I think you can see that over time people will become more aware of this.
And you're seeing some fringe movements. I mean, things like Diaspora is an interesting example of sort of a open source social media platform. Will people care, I guess, is sort of the big question. Will enough people say, no, I really want to control my privacy, to move to platforms that are transparent like that? And I think some of that's an education question. Some of it's a question of taste and choice. It's going to be an interesting thing to see. But as long as companies like Facebook are providing a lot of utility and not alienating customers too much at any one time, people will tend to stay where there's a lot of marginal utility. So I think that there's going to be a lot of time as this plays out where we sort of start to see how things interoperate. It's going to be harder and harder to own the whole space. Even if you have, you know, 750 million users, there's still overlap. Twitter still has 250 million that are, most of whom are the same people. I think it won't be a monopole-oriented universe, but it's going to be really interesting to see how it plays out.
And eventually we may see those nations come together and some sort of start to federate around, you know, common interests and trade.
And we're already seeing the start of that, right? And most small app developers are using or sort of piggybacking on Facebook or Twitter or other identity providers as their sort of way to log in.
So just to, you know, a couple of topics, I think, just to summarize this is, you know, what's at stake here is there is a technology story, but in a way it's not, it's a kernel of what's really going on. There are new business models surfacing out of this, new ways to bring innovation to market. The people, your time and your attention is a way to look at, you know, value of a company. It's not just the dollars you spend, but it's the time you're spending on those sites. social relationships when you start friending with people or starting to connect with them on LinkedIn, you are creating access to data, and you're allowing people to start to understand you and your relationships, and we've got operating systems. Right now, if you can see in the mobile operating system space, there's been tremendous movement around who's going to own what, iOS, Android, WebOS. We just saw is sort of in a state of flux.
It's the nicest way I've heard it put.
Thanks. people are going to start to need to take a real hard look at, what's their identity and privacy. The telecom industry, they're the ones transporting all this information around. How are they going to take advantage of what these opportunities are? Comcast now wants to be the provider of everything for you, not just your cable. Verizon, they're becoming one of the biggest cloud providers out there to businesses with integrated services.
And one of the biggest companies out there as a result.
Yep.
I mean, that's the other thing. You just look at the capitalization of these companies, and you can see how much leverage there is in the space. I mean, you're talking about Apple, the largest company in terms of market capitalization in the world. Verizon is, top 50, certainly. But.
And I think one of the places to look is actually in entertainment and gaming. Video gaming and the communities that are being built up around there and what's going on with TV and movie and distribution, those are some really interesting places where people really are thinking about content, how it's being distributed, how it's being consumed, and how users are engaging with that. And because it's happening at such a large scale, the cloud is really helping enable that.
Mm.
So there's time. We'll take some questions.
Yeah.
But thank you.
I want to remind our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and on the radio that we are listening to Cloud Computing and Customers, Strategies for Success, with Ian McFarland of Digital Garage and Chris Jones of Hot Studio. If there are any questions, please go ahead and line up over here. We take him over here at the mic. And I have a couple of questions for you, actually. I had two. One is you're talking about business models that are changing. And are there any business models you see on the horizon, things that you're just paying attention to that are maybe not fully developed yet, but you're seeing something shift out there?
I mean, I think the most obvious, biggest shift is just the shift to mobile. Mobile is absolutely where all, like 90% of the energy is, right? I mean, just you see it in just patent litigation and people buying up patent farms in order to try to defend that space. It's really clear to me that most human-computer interaction is going to be mediated through mobile devices. And that's a really nascent space. I mean, the smartphone itself, I mean, there were things that sort of you could consider smartphones, but it really wasn't until the first iPhone that people sort of got it, what was possible to do. It's early. It's very early days. I think there's a lot of business models there that haven't been really even discovered yet. But it's a very, very different frame to think about how somebody's access to information in the field carrying a small device as opposed to, sitting at a computer.
Chris, are you seeing anything?
Maybe it's also just sort of the rate of success. That companies are sort of going from zero to, they can go from zero to failure very quickly, but they can also go from zero to success very quickly.
Yeah.
And how that, how companies are sort of operationalizing that, how they can grow. Groupon is a recent example. I mean, their growth was staggering, and now they're, running into some challenges there. But, that the idea of having to scale, I think it was like, hiring 5,000 salespeople a month kind of thing was unbelievable.
Yeah. And I mean, these are huge engines of growth. And the lower friction entry point lets 1,000 flowers bloom or die or whatever. So I think it's only going to accelerate the rate of change and the rate of new ideas being tried out.
Another question. Ian, you had mentioned that we used to collect all this data, and then we just dumped all this data and tossed it. And now you're keeping it because you don't really know the questions that you want to ask of this data.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I think... there are obvious questions that we know to ask, like, you know, what, you know, when we tried this text, how did that affect conversion rate? How did, you know, was this this layout of the page stickier than the last layout of the page? There's lots of stuff like that that we know to ask, but there's what's interesting is sometimes you get some new insight later, and being able to go back to the original source data and sort of rerun your models and decide, you know, what should we have been measuring. That's something that's enabled by just the ability just to keep data forever.
Wow. And is there anything you're looking at? Are there questions that arose from the data that you collected before that just you didn't think of?
Well, there's a whole other class of questions. And when you sort of start to look at things just in terms of affinity mapping, just in terms of... turning algorithms loose on the data to sort of try to detect patterns. You may not even know what question to ask, but you can start to look at patterns of behavior.
I think a really interesting data set out there is the Enron email data set. So during the investigation in Enron, their email was actually made public. And a lot of people have actually been doing a lot of really interesting analytics against, you know, who knew who at what time and what were they talking about and subjects. And so... in a way, algorithms using that data set can then be applied to, you know, other investigations. And so it's...
you can do all sorts of really interesting social graph analysis just based on that. Even, you know, things, you know, people sort of often just think of the social graph as, you know, who's friends with whom. But when you start to actually look at people's behavior, first of all, behavior doesn't lie. People friend each other. It's, you know, I will admit to having said yes when somebody friended me that I didn't really like because of the social awkwardness side of it. But the people that I send email to and the people who send email to me, that kind of behavior doesn't lie, right? That's something that tells you about... Now, you may not be able to infer from that what the nature of that relationship is. That may not give you a qualitative read on sort of, like, that may not tell you whether I like them or not. I could be in litigation with somebody and we may be exchanging email a lot. I'm not. just to be clear.
Well, it's also, you know, you start to evaluate the quality of that. It's the quality of the relationship.
That's right.
You know,
a
friend relationship.
Density.
Is, yeah.
And the directionality. I mean, there's lots of stuff that people don't think to even think about in social graphs, but who influences whom? Who, you know, what is this person's cohort?
There's a really interesting service called Clout out there, and they're doing a really interesting job of looking at your social, your Twitter feed and other things, and really interesting how much clout you actually have in the social space, you know. And I think, again, it's, you know, that's going to become really interesting to understand, like, well, how much influence do I have? You know, or how am I a follower, or am I a leader, or am I, you know, a pundit or whatnot? You know, you can start to understand those things.
Yeah, and there's lots of places to apply machine learning to these things and discover things that you wouldn't, again, that you wouldn't have thought to ask.
Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. Question?
Ian, in your biography, you were mentioning that you're in Japan now, and I was very interested in, the world seems to be shrinking, so
so I was interested in your use of the cloud in Japan, and maybe you could talk a little bit about some other metrics that we are able to use today. Can you tell us a little bit
about
that?
Yeah, sure. One project that I'm associated with is Safecast, which is basically taking... this is a nonprofit, open source project to try to collect radiation data. After the earthquake and after the Fukushima meltdown, there were folks who felt like the government wasn't providing as much information as everybody really wanted to have, and so this is a project to sort of go collect. You know, the team has built Geiger counters that measure it consistently in a normable way. And we'll go do, you know, basically take commodity, everything except for the Geiger counter tubes is basically commodity hardware where we can just go, you know, use GPS, use, you know, web-based data collection, like data collection services that we built to sort of collect these large amounts of data and just sort of take, you know, and be able to do driving surveys and just collect huge amounts of data. This is something you could have done sooner, but the ability to just sort of collect arbitrarily large amounts of, you know, thousands and thousands of data points and plot them on a map over time. You know, take when the measurement occurred, the amount of radiation detected, and plot that, you know, in a two-dimensional space over the landscape really tells people something that they weren't able to see before. Mm-hmm. And so then the ability then to expose this again through just standard web-based services that also lets other people operate on the data, and you know, it separates the notion of how you collect the data with how you operate on the data and infer things from the data. Then you can, you know, you could take that information and correlate it with health records or with epidemiological studies. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of things that you can do once this data is sort of taken out of, you know, the walled garden and put into the public sphere where people can interoperate on it.
I think it's a great story, and I think all these things were kind of possible before cloud computing. I mean, it's not that these things were impossible, but it's really the accessibility and of the resources to do that, and it's really sort of accelerating the napkin sketch to actually a product out there.
That's right.
You know, it's sort of being able to say, like, here's an idea. Now I have, there's a set of technologies and an infrastructure that I can actually go out and actually acquire very easily and test those ideas.
And I think it's a really important point to sort of underline. Larry Ellison fairly famously said that there was nothing new about the cloud. And I think on some level that's true. The ability to have machines out there, we could have done this whenever. But the fact is just this ability to buy very small components of it on demand, certainly we were capable of it, but we weren't doing it. And it still is fundamentally transformative to how we do business. And we can see that in these examples. You know, these are things Safecast wouldn't have been able to go collect, like put together. We didn't have any money when we started, so you know, it all started as a little Kickstarter project. We wouldn't have been able to go, you know, buy servers and equipment. I mean, the biggest expense we had is Geiger counter tubes, which apparently have gone up a lot in cost lately because there's a lot of sudden market demand. So this is something that, though it would have been technically feasible, would not have been economically feasible. And I think ultimately that's kind of the big story, the one takeaway about cloud is that it's not that it changes the technology. It does. There are some qualitative differences, but it really changes the economics in a fundamental way.
Yeah. Do you both have, Chris, advice for startups? And Ian, if I'm a startup and I'm looking at this great big opportunity, what advice do you have for startups, people wanting to do something new?
Ship it. Do it now.
Right now.
Don't wait. Somebody else is thinking about it probably in San Francisco.
I think that's actually it. Is be aware to actually get your ideas out there. Realize that your assumptions are only so good as long as someone's actually you're testing them.
Right. Start validating your hypotheses. Start by trying something out. I mean, that's the Giglog story was that. We had a hypothesis. We tested it. We learned new stuff. Then we changed what we did based on it. In our case, we stopped doing it, which is a very good thing to do if your idea is not working. Sticking with it's good, too.
But. Yeah, and it's also interesting, I think, you know, there's a lot of virtue in sort of keeping it simple, right?
Yes.
That Dropbox is an extremely simple service. It's about file synchronization. And they sort of identified, you know, hey, I can use cloud storage. It's well defined. The operations around it are well defined. There's a service that provides a good level of service, and I can start to build on top of that. And I don't necessarily need to build all these bells and whistles.
That's right.
And they're still a very simple service. You know, even with all their success. I mean, they certainly have some interesting features, but it's. It's about reliability, quality of service, quality of the product.
And that simplicity is hard. I mean, it's very easy to look at it and go, wow, I could have done that. Well, you probably couldn't because you probably wouldn't have thought of how to make it quite that easy to do. I mean, honestly, Dropbox as a service doesn't do anything, again, that you couldn't do technically. You could get your own S3 account and upload stuff to S3 and then don't download it from your laptop and, or from your phone. But
and people
People
were, and then someone said, you know, I'll make this easy for other people to do.
But packaging it up in a way that actually has some real ease of use, simplicity. I mean, this is the big Apple lesson, right? Like, the iPod is not innovative. There, I said it. It is in the sense that they actually cared about ease of use and execution. Yeah, and the user experience was at the forefront. It's not, I mean, there were MP3 players. We used to call them MP3 players. Does everybody remember when we called them MP3 players? Yeah, so that's interesting, isn't it? My favorite graph is one that shows profitability versus market share for the iPhone in the last quarter. There was a thing in CBS MarketWatch had some stat where the iPhone is responsible for, I think, 3.5% of the market share in that quarter, but 35% of the profit. And I think, you know, so if you're an early stage company, think about how you do things really, really well, solve problems really, really well, and get them out in front of customers and find out if they care.
Thank you.
Hey, I've got a question about large companies and even governments that use cloud. You mentioned a lot about small ones and how they benefited from it, and I wonder if you could tell us about large companies or governments and maybe what problems they have adopting it and what they should be doing.
One of the big problems that governments have is regulation around data standards, basically. And I think, you know, there's a lot of work going on around that, and it's going to be but you know, if you have government agencies are not just allowed to go use S3. There's a bunch of standards that they have to comply with.
They can use Dropbox, though, which is interesting.
That wasn't easy, though, I'm sure.
That wasn't easy, and it's one of those things where, only recently, only this year, I think they've allowed, iPads or tablets were just recently allowed on the floor of Congress.
Mm.
And so it's, something where governments are slow to adopt these things, probably for some valid concerns, but probably also just,
For legislative reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, I think companies are seeing benefits from this. I think, you mentioned Salesforce before. I think, them buying Heroku is interesting because, Salesforce has a relationship with most of the Fortune 50 companies where they've been kind of the ones telling people it was okay to put their stuff out in the cloud in the first place. So, I mean, I think part of it is just developing trust that these are actually secure ways to do things. They have to actually be secure. I mean, part of it is some of these, you maybe don't want all your Social Security account information on S3 until somebody's done a proper audit to make sure that that's a good idea. Of course,
it probably is.
Well, I'm sure it is, and your Social Security number is public record, so.
Yeah, it's... I think in terms of actually how enterprise businesses are using it, I think there's sort of this certain, getting operational efficiency out of, virtualizing all their systems. I think there's also sort of a trend to start to adopt, try out pilot programs.
Yes.
Within larger enterprises, they're more readily able to do that.
I think you're going to see a lot of that. I mean, one of the projects that we did at Pivotal was for Best Buy, and it was the Best Buy Remix API. Totally new line of business, no revenue on it on day one, and so it was something safe to experiment with. Yeah. And I think you're going to see a lot of people sort of, doing this entrepreneurship kind of thing where they'll try something out with something that's not revenue critical on day one. They'll try it. It'll work. It'll probably work way better than what they're used to.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll say, well, maybe we should do this to something that's a little bit... I mean, we did another project for another company. It was totally... was core line of business, and I can't talk about it. But... so companies are sort of moving down that, down that value chain, doing things that more and more are critical line of business, and they're finding that this is efficient, works better. I mean, we find that companies are doing, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, it would be great if within enterprises, groups could feel more entrepreneurial.
Right.
It doesn't have to be a product out in the consumer space. We spent a lot of time this evening talking about that, but within the enterprise, you know, does someone have a better way to manage, you know, HR or a better way to, you know, do some sort of, you know, finance processing?
And I think consumer expectations are changing the landscape for businesses too. You know, you're having people who are used to, you know, using stuff that's nice and Ajax-y and has a nice user experience, and then they go into these corporate IT systems and they were all written, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and, you know, the rank and file employees are having a problem using them, and people are starting to realize that there's a huge efficiency problem there. I mean, I think ultimately the economics of this stuff will win out and will drive adoption. But I mean, we find that somebody doing Agile and doing Rails and doing cloud all together, I would reasonably estimate that they're going to be about 10 times as efficient in terms of the amount of work that they get done per unit of cost or unit of time. And the people who do that are going to have a huge advantage. I mean, I always sort of I always want to bet on the mammals, not on the dinosaurs.
but in some cases, a lot of companies are you know, they're dinosaurs in that
That's true.
Metaphor and comfortable there. And it's hard to make
Sometimes
a dinosaur.
There's
a
not
mammal.
Good mammals around. Right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And,
okay, we're at the time of our program where we have one last question, and I'd like to ask both of you for your closing comments in tweetable form. What would you like to leave everybody with?
Wow.
Well,
I don't know.
Yeah, I shouldn't count letters.
You know, Japanese, you can get a lot more into 140 characters.
Oh, there you go. I see why you moved. Okay.
It's really just what you'd like to leave folks with. Sure. To take away that can be most important right now.
The disruptive thing about cloud is the economics, not the technology.
Wow.
I think people really need to understand their identity in the cloud and start to, you know, take on the responsibility of managing that. Sorry, that's not 140. But
you could fit it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of room in 140 characters.
But I do think that that's an important piece is, you know, cloud's great, but it's also people need to take some responsibility for themselves.
People hate that.
I know.
You sure we have to do that?
I'd like to thank.
I'm going to.
I'd like to thank tonight Chris Jones of Hot Studio and Ian McFarland of Digital Garage for being here tonight. We also like to thank our audiences here at the club and those on our radio audience and our podcast audience and our video audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.